गुरुवे गुरुचंद्राय कृष्णाय कृष्ण भक्ताय तद भक्ताय गुड इवनिंग टू ऑल. प्रणाम. वेलकम. थैंक सो मच फॉर कमिंग टुडे. नाइस टू सी यू ऑल. Let me see you all first before saying nice to see you all. I mean, I will say the same nice to see you all, but I want to see who are you all. So thank you, Sudevi, for the introduction. Thank you. Radha Priyaji. Thank you. You are there. Thank you for your offering. So yeah, the other day we were sharing a few words regarding a recent book published, Evolution in Divine Love, and today I felt like sharing a few more words about it, also in connection to a parikram that we have been conducting simultaneously these days with a group of 25, 26 pilgrims here in Navadvip, trying to plumb the depths of what it means to be in Navadvip, to plumb the depths of what it means for us to have Sriman Mahaprabhu, Sri Chaitanya Dev as our Ishtadev in our Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition. What's the heights, the depths, the breadths of Gaur Tattva? How that all speaks to us, where we are, whenever we are in our journey, in our bhakti journey. So my recent book, Evolution in Divine Love, as the title suggests, speaks about love in constant growth. Love as the ultimate, most foundational expression of reality, love. And love to be the ultimate, it has to be ever evolving. Love is not as we are saying today, love is it's not a relic from the past. It's not a museum piece. Love is the most dynamic force of all existence, which keeps everything orbiting around its center. So Srimad Bhagavatam will say, Hai tu kiya pratihata, right? So vai pun samparo dharmo yatu bhakti radoksha. Hai tu kiya pratihata. Those two words are very important if we want jayatma suprasiddhati. Which all, we all want, jayatma suprasiddhati, that our self experiences comprehensive satisfaction, full content, and more. But first we have to understand how bhakti, devotion, loving devotion, is a high to kiya pratihata. It's its own cause, it has no cause, it's causeless. It's nothing else producing it. It's bhakti for the sake of bhakti. Bhakti comes from bhakti, bhakti goes to bhakti. Like Srimad Bhagavatam explains, bhaktiya sanjataya bhaktiya. Source of bhakti is bhakti, the goal of bhakti is bhakti. That's a very interesting math, right? Bhakti comes from bhakti, bhakti goes to bhakti. So God love is its own cause, but it's apratihata, which means it's uncontainable. It's constantly erupting into newer dimensions. Love is not content to remain still. That's why we have a dancing god, right? What makes Krishna dance? Love. What makes Mahaprabhu dance? His inner experience of love. As we were saying the other day, we belong to a movement, Mahaprabhu's movement. But what's Mahaprabhu's movement? How it all originated, which was the original movement in Mahaprabhu's movement? Something deeply moving in Mahaprabhu's heart. His inner deep experiences of, in this case, the heart of Sri Radha, Krishna, relishing the heart of his utmost beloved Sri Radha. That's very moving for God. So that's moving him. That's initial Mahaprabhu's movement. Dancing, moving deeply in his heart. It's apratihata, it's uncontainable, cannot be stopped, resisted. He starts to move up externally, out of his internal movement. And his external movement starts to cause some inner movement in other people who witnesses that. Oh, imagine witnessing Mahaprabhu's movements, dancing, moving. That moves you inside first, and that takes you to move outside as well. And you start to dance, and it becomes like an epidemic, it becomes contagious. And eventually, we have a movement with different names and shapes and institutional structures. Nothing wrong with any of that, as long as we remember how the movement started with the movement in the depths of the heart of God. And that moved heart from the divine touch our heart. That's the extension of Parampara, still the volcanic eruption of Mahaprabhu erupting, sprinkling, even us centuries after. And somehow we are moved to be here today. Something has moved you to come here today and sit and share with all of us today. So the movement is, the very word movement is something needs to be in movement, something needs to remain dynamic. So love is that nature. Ahaituki apratihata. Love is its own sweet cause, and love tends to more love. Love is insatiable. That's one of the main points in my recent book. Love creates its own form of paradoxical dissatisfaction. Sorry to say that for those who are practicing bhakti. I just want peace, I want relief, I want satisfaction. And now you're bringing holy dissatisfactions? That's too complicated. Give me peace, shanti, 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 and let's stop the class right here. Sorry, guys, but we are in the land of Mahaprabhu, and it is him who say, na prema gandhasti darapi meharu. No? He, the very prem purushottam, the very personification of prem, of divine love, he same. Prem Purushottam, he said, na prema gandhasti darapi meharu. In me, there is not even the aroma of prem. How is that possible? I mean, if we have to boil down to only one living entity in planet Earth in the existence of humanity who had prem, that would be Prem Purushottam Sri Chaitanya Dev. And that person happens to say, I don't even have the aroma of prem. And when we witness his life, when even people from sister traditions will witness the life story of Mahaprabhu, like different Christian priests that I read, they will say, Sri Chaitanya Dev has exhibited all the symptoms of love that all the religious tradition across the world speak about. So it's undeniable for everyone. But he subjectively, genuinely, sincerely says, not even the aroma of that is in me. Achintya, paradoxical. Why? Because again, the nature of love is the more love you have, the more love you glimpse, how much more love you can have. That's what you glimpse when you have love. When you really have love, you cannot assert yourself. No. Look how loving I am. No. I've made it. I've colonized love. I put my flag. I have it. No. It's like humility. No? The moment you say I'm humble, you are not humble. It's very counterintuitive. You cannot say you have it because the very moment you say that, you don't have it. It's very interesting. The same with love. And that's why Sanatana Goswami say between love, prema and dānya, love and humility, one is cause and effect of each other. The more love you have, the more humble you become, the more humble you become, the more love you have. But the moment you affirm any of both, they disappear. They are so, how to say, love, humility, these attributes, these qualities are so noble, so dignifying that we can never have enough of them. We can never fully possess them. So the moment we attempt to put them in a box and say, I have it, this lift our fingers and it's like, so I can only remain in association with them without ever claiming ownership on those qualities. I'm not to be the owner of love. I'm to be owned by love. I'm not to be the possessor of humility. I'm to be possessed by humility. It requires basically an ego death to be able to enter into that relationship. A death to the false self, which is survives or thinks it survives by asserting itself as possessor, controller, and so on. So this is the life and the dynamics of love. For us, for God Himself. That's very interesting. That's not only our case, but that's the case even for the divine, for the sweet absolute. Bhagavan Sri Krishna, in my personal opinions and subjective, hopefully spiritual bias, is his most unique expression as Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. I like to call Krishna, well, Prabhupada liked to call Krishna Supreme Personality of Godhead. I like to call Mahaprabhu the Supreme Personality of Krishna. Because as Sri Chaitanya Dev, Krishna can fulfill those desires that he cannot fulfill in Vrindavan as Braja Krishna. So we have, without Mahaprabhu, without Gaur Lila, Krishna Lila, and I will say something strong here. Get it in context, please. Don't make a clip out of context from what I'm about to say. Be merciful to me. Without Gaur Lila, Krishna Lila is a failure. Ooh, strong. I mean, I'm not saying that Krishna is feeling that subjectively, because at the height of Krishna Lila, as we were talking this morning, yesterday, the whole parikrama, we were talking about that. No? One of the birthplaces, we began our parikrama going to Yogapit, the birthplace of Sri Chaitanya Dev. But before that, we spoke another of another birthplace of Gaur Lila, which is Krishna Lila. Sometimes we think Gaur Lila is just a mere bridge to Krishna Lila. Thank you, Mahaprabhu, to come on earth, bring Yuga Dharma, Gaur Hari Bol. We cross the bridge, we go to Vrindavan. We don't need the bridge anymore. You can even burn the bridge. Let's go to Braja Lila. Gaur Lila disappeared. But many of our acharyas will not agree with that. One sense, we could see Gaur Lila as a culmination of Krishna, not necessarily as the entry point, and once we enter there, it's over, it's gone. How to think about that? Well, what's the culmination of Krishna Lila as we know it from the Srimad Bhagavatam? One sense, the Srimad Bhagavatam, we will say in our particular view, in our tradition, Bhagavatam is the culmination of Shastra, of revelation. In one sense, of course, it's ever evolving also. What's the Bhagavatam? That's another conversation. It's only a book, only 18,000 verses that they were reading and sharing. How once someone brought to Srila Prabhupada the case of John of Arc, this French Christian saint. So what do you think about John of Arc? He said, who is she? Oh, this is a Christian. Oh, so she's part of the Bhagavatam, Prabhupada says. Because whomever is a genuine lover of God, that's Bhagavatam. That's a broad definition of what's Bhagavatam. We tend to, I think of the things as, oh, Srimad-Bhagavatam is this book that begins Janmadiyasyayata and then ends Namasankirtanam Yasya. That's the last verse. That's the first verse. In between, we have these chapters, these numbers, boxes. That's Bhagavatam. Where is Joan of Arc here? Well, we will say the whole Bhagavatam is about Sri Radha, and someone could also argue, where is Sri Radha in the Bhagavatam? You have to learn to read in between the lines to find all these personalities. So if we learn to see, to approach revelation with the proper eye, you will see every genuine lover of God in the history of humanity existing in between the lines of the Bhagavad. It's a truly non-sectarian offering. As Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur will explain in his beautiful presentation on the Bhagavad, the religion of love, deeply universal. That's Mahaprabhu's gift to the world. But again, the birthplace of such generosity and broad-mindedness comes from the holy dissatisfaction that love creates, the holy thirst for more that is insatiable in its own unique way. So in one sense, we could thread the beginning of Gaur Lila, it's an eternal reality, but how it manifests on earth in the culmination of Krishna Lila. Again, not Gaur Lila as the entry point and game over for Gaur Lila, But follow Krishna Lila, Srimad Bhagavatam, the culmination of all revelation. 10th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, the culmination of the culmination. Braja Lila as the culmination of the 10th canto. Rasa Lila as the culmination of Braja Lila. So we are at this point, we are in the culmination of the culmination of the cum. We are there. We have this Rasa Lila, Rasa Panchadhyaya, these five chapters of Rasa Lila. Krishna disappearing from Rasa Lila with certain purposes to take the whole experience to another level. Gopis joining in separately, looking for him in madness, not finding him, finding he has won go with someone else, seeing the footsteps, all the symptoms, like mad woman in the forest speaking to the animals and the birds and the plants, as if they were engaging in conversation, whereas Krishna and hearing replies. Long story short, as we know, they find Sri Radha, having been abandoned by Krishna, they join her without jealousy, without envy. They have full empathy. They connect in Sankirtan, in Sadhu Sangha, in separation from Krishna. Which is an example for how we are supposed to get, how our get-togethers are supposed to be. No. Sadhu Sangha, Sankirtan, and genuine longing in the heart, in which each one is nourishing each other, supporting each other. And Krishna is witnessing all of this behind the tamal tree, camouflaging between the tamal's complexion and his uncle Peck complexion, very similar. Having disappeared with certain purpose in mind, so the gopis' love reaches a new level in separation. But after witnessing the glory of the love of the gopis, a new purpose, unexpected purpose come to his heart. I don't know that quality of love that Sri Radha is expressing. I need to taste that. What's the glory of her love? What's the happiness she derives? What's the beauty she perceives in me? What's the happiness she derived from that? I have no clue, Krishna says. The omniscient God says, I don't know. It's okay to say I don't know sometimes. Even Krishna leads by example. Yadyada charati. Whatever great personalities do, we follow. So you can say, I don't know, I'm following great personalities. I don't know. Someone asked once Srila Prabhupada, which is who is a yuga avatar for Treta Yuga? He said, I don't know. We are in Kali Yuga. Let's be focused, right? Let's not die of an overdose of curiosity, unnecessary curiosity. So Krishna said, I don't know. But that unknowing led him to a new level of knowing himself, knowing the heart of Radha, exploring all these possibilities as Mahaprabhu. Because when Krishna realized the glory of the love of Radha and the gopis, or had a glimpse of that, he reappears in their midst eventually, as we know, and he confesses, as we were talking today in the morning, we went to Madangopal temple. Bhagavatam describes Krishna's reappearance in their midst. How does the verse start? Tesam virabhuk chauri chauri smayamanam pitambara dharashrakvi sakshat Krishna's reappearing amidst the gopis with a yellow cloth around his neck, expressing in a very unique way. He's wearing his yellow cloth, which sometimes people will wear if they will be a criminal. So he appears like, in the face of the glory of your love, how much you love me and how little I'm reciprocating, I feel like a criminal. Some water, Namantari? Sure. Haven't touched, it's here available. Whomever needs. So Krishna's coming from that place, right? He's witnessing, these devotees love me so much. And of course, Krishna tries pretty hard to love them back, right? Yayatamam prapadim titamstatayiva bhajamyam. How you love me, I reciprocate accordingly. That's Bhagavad Gita. Bhagavatam, he no longer says that. In the face of the gopis' love, Krishna says, I have to contradict myself. Wow. The love of the gopis make God contradict himself. Krishna says, he says here, na pare ham niravadya sanjaya. I cannot repay you back your love. And you bring, no, but you say that, Bhagavad Gita 4.11. That's Bhagavad Gita 4.11. Here we are, 10th canto of the Bhagavatam. We are another situation. Desha kala patram place and circumstance. Here I cannot repay back. But Krishna is not ungrateful. So even if you cannot repay back, I'll try to give whatever I can the best way possible. So that's Mahaprabhu's Lila. Gaur Lila is Krishna's attempt to pay back, Krishna's attempt to explore the heart of Radha, Krishna's attempt to make devotees for Sri Radha, to pay back his debt that is ever increasing. And all of this is coming because of the ever-evolving nature of love. Krishna is witnessing the heart of Radha, the ever-evolving nature of Radha's love, ever-expanding. And he's becoming more and more beautiful because of that. So that's interesting because Mahaprabhu's main purposes are twofold, I would say. One, I want to understand Radha, but also I want to understand my beauty seen through her eyes. That's a very interesting idea we were talking about the other day. We have our own ideas about ourselves, sometimes not too generous, let's be honest. So many times we actually need to see ourselves through the eyes of someone who loves us. Because many times we don't have much generous self-perception. Sometimes the hardest self-perception is on ourselves. So when we hear about ourselves from someone who truly loves us, then we may be able to gain bigger insight that somehow, sometimes how we see ourselves. So of course that's applied to us, but also in some way applies to Bhagavan. He's has his own way of perceiving himself, but how Radha is seeing me, what beauty she sees in me. I mean, I know I'm I mean not from a narcissistic point, but Krishna says, I know I'm beautiful. I mean, my name is there, right? The all attractive. What can I do? Krishna says, I happen to be the all attractive. Right? Like the soul is described by Krishna in the Gita Acharya 2:29. The soul is amazing. So you have all the rights in the world to say I'm amazing. But you have all the rights to, in the world not to be proud of that. Because I did not create myself. I happen to be amazing. We happen to be amazing. And Krishna say, I happen to be the all attractive. What to do? But the nature of his all attractiveness is that the all attractive becomes at every moment more attractive. That really means to be the all attractive. It's not that you are super attractive, but you can no longer become more attractive than that. There is a final, like, fixed maximum to being the all attractive. It cannot pass beyond. That wouldn't be the all attractive. That's why Krishna Das Kaviraj Goswami says, Krishna's beauty is increasing at every moment. The all attractive becomes paradoxically all the more attractive. So we can call Krishna the all the more attractive. The all attractive is kind of limiting. The all the more attractive. So every time, at every nanosecond and every blink and between the blink, Krishna is becoming more attractive. And then he says, and the love of his devotees is becoming bigger. It's growing. And the more the love increases of his devotees, the more Krishna's beauty increases. Their love makes him more beautiful. If you are surrounded by people who loves you will look more beautiful. But it's not necessarily your own merit. Oh, I'm so beautiful. But their love is beautifying me. That's how love operates. This is not about biological aesthetics, but something deeper. If you are surrounded by genuine love impacting on yourself, that will be reflected in your being. And God is not an exception to that. So Krishna, that's why the Bhagavatam is saying in this verse we referred before, Sakshan Manmatan Manmata. When Krishna reappeared in the midst of the gopis, he reappeared after witnessing how much they love me. He already had an idea how much they love, but now he's witnessing a new degree of love. So a new degree of love creates in him a new degree of beauty. That's why he reappears and describes his describes Sakshan Manmata Manmata. The cupid of cupids, more attractive than the more attractive. Why? Because he has just witnessed a never knew love, never of love he never could conceive. That impacted on him, he became more beautiful. Yes, try the best you can to understand all this stuff. No problem. Till the point that holy smoke starts to come from your ears. That's part of the process, right? We need to put all our faculties to their best usage till they collapse in a sacred way, and we are called just to surrender fully. So yeah, Krishna reappears among their midst, say, I cannot repay back, I'll try my best. That's the height of Krishna Lila. And in that verse, Sanatana Goswami comments in Brihad Bhagavatamrita, in this verse, Gaur Lila is born. This is announcing the descent of Sri Chaitanya. When Krishna says, I cannot pay back for your love, but once in a day of Brahma, I will come as a sadhu and I will try to do something about it, repay back singing the glories of your love for me. So who is God as a sadhu? Who is God as a sadaka? Mahaprabhu. Mahaprabhu's God as a sadaka, also reaffirming us who are sadakas with all our ups and downs and lefts and rights. It's glorious to be a sadaka. God himself needs to become a sadaka to accomplish his mission. That's Mahaprabhu. And we may say, okay, but that's Mahaprabhu. I'm not Mahaprabhu. I'm a sadaka, and my ups and downs are really ups and downs. The undulation is wild in my case. Still, our acharyas, our guardian angels will say, all that is happening in the context of bhakti. If you are honest and sincere, all that is glorious. Like I always say, when Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur describes bhakti, describes the stage before nishtha, anishtita bhajana kriya, unstable bhakti, he gives all these symptoms. Which may sound one more embarrassing than the other. Right? Utsa Amayi doesn't sound too embarrassing, the first one. I'm filled with enthusiasm. But then comes the second one, which is as much as I was filled with enthusiasm, the next day I'm like, I think I'm leaving the whole thing. And then the struggle and the ups and downs and difficult to maintain your vows, blah, 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 all this stuff. I won't ask here for any public confession. Say, do you check all those boxes of unstable bhakti? But probably most well say, I know what you're talking about. That's my unauthorized biography, those symptoms. But Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur is not telling all that to bully us and to make us feel toxic shame, but to say, all that is happening. If that's happening, that means you are on the path, the unstable chapter of the path. But that's the sacred path of bhakti. So as unstable, as embarrassing as that is, that's a confirmation that you're on the path. So you should be celebrating that. Not stay there forever, but as long as I need to stay there, because I may not be able to just press a button and be in Nishtha Rucha Shakti Bhava Prem, I have to appreciate and feel grateful. Oh, I'm on the path. Yes, stable, unstable, sorry, ups and downs, but it's part of the journey. It's a particular landscape I need to explore in my journey now. So there's a glory to be a sadaka. That was my point. Mahaprabhu comes as a sadaka to tell us it's glorious what you are doing. Yeah, you may feel it's embarrassing. You may feel you are falling short from the goal. But again comes the main point. In the face of ever-evolving love, you will always feel I'm falling short of the goal because love is always evolving. That's why Mahaprabhu, as I said before, says, "Na prema gandhos chidarapi meharo." In me, there is not the ascent of love. So like, you are full of love, but the more you have love, the less you feel you have it. It's so paradoxical. You need to navigate that paradox without going crazy, right? Without feeling terribly bad about yourself, without making the spiritual journey like a goal-oriented, goal-obsessed thing that I'm here and I need to be there. And once I'm there, I got my trophy, Prem Bhakti, game over. Not game over, no. Prem Bhakti means the whole thing's, we are warming up now. Now we are starting to enter the real thing, ever-evolving love in eternity. Because even if you officially attain Prem Bhakti, that doesn't mean the love stopped growing there. On the contrary, now you have Prem Bhakti, you are free from all obstacles, from anarthas. Now love can grow exponentially without any impediments forever, without end. And those who are there, again, they are never saying, "Hey, I have Prem Bhakti, I have love, I'm done. I'm fully satisfied." That's not happening, Gaur Lila. It's a sacred dissatisfaction, sacred, holy. It's not this dissatisfaction we may be accustomed to experience. So, this is what Narad Muni, as I sometimes share, this interesting section where Narad Muni once is meeting Bhagavan and he tells, "Can I ask you a blessing?" Bhagavan says, "Yes." Narad Muni is having a very deep experience of the ever-expanding horizon of love and how much more love is there to offer, to experience, to serve, to love. How much love is there to be loved? So Narad Muni, in that moment of profound epiphany, asks Bhagavan, "This is my blessing. May nobody ever feel entirely satisfied with your love. That's the blessing I'm requesting. That may nobody ever feel that they are fully satisfied with your love. Because the nature of love will never create that. So may nobody become self-deceived, thinking, 'Oh, I have love now, I'm fully satisfied. I don't want any more of this.'" So he presents this unique petition, and Bhagavan replies in an even more astonishing way, because he says, "Dear Narad, you have quite pretty good traveling abilities. You can go anywhere. So you have seen a lot of places, a lot of people, a lot of my devotees, a lot of my lovers, a lot of those who have the love you are talking about. You tell me, have you ever seen any of them fully satisfied with the love they've had?" And now I'm going to say, "No." "So why you're asking that? That's already happening. Already happened. Those who love me are never satisfied with their love. Not again in an ungrateful way. On the contrary, they have love, but they want to love more. They want to love more. So Krishna tells Narada, ask for a more realistic, fulfilling benediction, something else. So that's the nature of love. Yeah, on one level, we can say Krishna is Atmaram, self-satisfied. But Bhaktivinoda Thakur will say there is also the concept of Pararam, which is God is self-satisfied, but God on top of that is divinely dissatisfied. That's how the whole Rasa Lila starts. Krishna is Atmaram, but he sees the full moon in Vrindavan, and he becomes inclined to play his flute and enjoy with the gopis. So he's self-satisfied, but he's called to engage in love, to engage in play. Out of fullness, the fullness of love. So that's the God we worship. That's the God we worship. Someone who is willing to expand and grow. Krishna is becoming, as we say before, more beautiful at every moment. Try to think about it, but maybe don't try to think about it. It's beyond adoksha, it's beyond our faculties. So if Krishna is becoming more beautiful, more attractive at every moment, and Krishna means the all attractive. So the all attractive Krishna becomes more Krishna at every moment. So there's another point, important point there. If Krishna is becoming more Krishna at every moment, Mahaprabhu is becoming more Mahaprabhu at every moment, then how we are supposed to relate to them? Because if we have had an experience of them in our lives, but now they have upgraded themselves to a deeper version, more beautiful version, then I should no longer go to them with my outdated experience, expecting them to respond to my already outdated version of them. You follow my point? So that demands that we also enter into an ever-evolving journey to keep the pace of an ever-evolving God. Right? That's the daily dynamics in the spiritual world. And that invites us for a deep journey of surrender, of letting go, of renunciation, and not only renunciation of gross, exploitative, selfish activities, but also renunciation of outdated ideas about God, or even renunciation about outdated experiences of God that were beautiful, perfectly true, but now we are ready for something more. Right? Again, the example I always give is like if I go to my mom, say, "Mom, yes." She's in Argentina now, so that's why I'm making the phone move to me. She's not living around the corner. I will meet in a few weeks. So, "Mom, yes, I really enjoy that version of yourself and of myself when I was 3 months old. That was so cute, right? You were changing my diapers. There was so much connection and intimacy. I like you to go back to that version of yourself." My mom will call a psychiatrist or something for that. Say, no. That, as beautiful as that was, it will be dysfunctional to go back there. Because it was beautiful, now we are ready for something else, right? So it was beautiful. We are not denying that. We are not ungrateful. We are not saying that was false, that was partial, that was illusory. No, that was as good as it could get at that time. But life is moving, we are growing, now we are ready for something more. So that's like a way of an analogy to say, in the same way or in a similar way, we are developing a relationship with the divine. And sometimes we should be careful not to go to Krishna in that same way. "Oh, Krishna, please be for me that person you were when I was in my diapers, in my devotional diapers." No? Because we have our bhakti kindergarten chapter, but then we are expected to grow out, to outgrow our diapers and be ready for another chapter, another chapter, another chapter. So we should be very, very careful not to try to demand that Krishna remains in kindergarten because we are not willing to leave kindergarten. So Krishna remain being that particular version that is very comfortable for me, so I don't have to grow. Don't make Krishna cry in that way with such a proposal. So that's why we have to exhibit arguably one of the highest forms of renunciation. Here you have a renunciant talking to you, Padmanabha Maharaj. Because sometimes we might think, "Oh, renunciation is this, renunciation is that," but when you start to go into fine things, one of the most challenging things you have to renounce, and not only for a sannyasi, for all of us, renounce the at over overly excessive attachment to certain experiences you've had of God, which are all real, perfect, beautiful, unforgettable. They are the foundation of our faith. That's why we are here. All the glories to all of that. And because of all of that, now I'm ready for a new experience, for a new chapter. Krishna is ready. He's waiting. But we have to show up for a new version of the relationship. Let's be careful not putting God in a box. This God, boom. Game over. Now I practice. And God is always the same person in the same box. That's not sadhana bhakti. Sadhana bhakti practice, avideya practice, has to be guided by a proper sambandha, proper foundational knowledge, Part of which is the divine is always evolving in its beauty, in its upgraded experience of love. So shall we. On that foundation, we engage in Abhideya practice. With this awareness, reality is growing and expanding and moving. So that's a very interesting perspective. For me, very exciting personally, at the same time, very challenging, let's be honest, but very exciting at the same time. So, generally, what's exciting, the most exciting prospects include a good degree of challenge. And those who are not very challenging are more boring, stagnant, complacent ideas or experiences. So we have to make our choices in life. But Krishna consciousness is very dynamic, that's for sure. Because Krishna is very dynamic. And again, that's been shown in the form of Mahaprabhu. We are here in Mayapur again, the birthplace, Sri Chaitanya Dev, but again, his birthplace, before the official birthplace on earth, happened thousands of years ago in Krishna Lila in Vrindavan, when Krishna witnesses the love of the gopis, as I said. He's willing to explore Radha's heart and to enter into that adventure called Krishna Lila, Gaur Lila, sorry. That's a new adventure. Lila could be translated as adventure, adventurous play. As one Christian friend of mine, she's a Franciscan nun, she's also a scientist, theologian, and she said, God is more interested in adventure than in preserving the status quo. That's a good one. God is more interested in adventure than in preserving the status quo. Well, another way of saying, on one side, you have the notion of God as cosmic administrator, keeper of order, things in place, status quo. Okay, there is a part of that. But only that being God, for a Gaudiya Vaishnava, it's like that's pretty boring. And then you have the God interest in adventure, the God who plays, the divine, Deva in Sanskrit. The divine comes from Deva. Deva comes from the roots, div, which means to play. So Deva means he who plays. Arjuna calls Krishna the Gita Deva Deva, which means he who plays a lot. He who only plays at the end of the day. So, Krishna in Vrindavan is he who only plays a play so hard, so deep, becomes so absorbed in play that he forgets even that he's God. That means you are playing. But you are, I don't know, the president of India. You have many responsibilities. You have to remember yourself, I'm the president of India. But sometimes you want to take a break from that. It's too much. Let's play. And the grandson of the president comes home and says, Grandpa, now be a giraffe. Okay. The grandpa won't say, hey, I'm the president of India. How you dare to invite me to be a giraffe? The president is happy to embrace some, take a break from being a president of India. I mean, a giraffe. He starts trying his best to be a giraffe and tries to extend his neck a little bit more and walk. And the grandchild jumps on the back. Now do like that. Now a snake to the floor. The president of India is there. But hopefully, if he's a good grandpa, he's totally oblivious and he has forgotten that he's the president of India at that moment. He's somewhere else. And that somewhere else is more real than all the formal bureaucratic stuff at the presidential house, right? Because he's really immersed in play. So that's Krishna in Vrindavan, and that's Mahaprabhu here. So immersed in Leela, so immersed in play, the notion of God became secondary. That's interesting. I like to say Krishna is not an aspect of God, but God is an aspect of Krishna. Right. And Krishna is an aspect of Mahaprabhu. Whoops. Right? I mean, Krishna and Mahaprabhu are the same person, Force. Let's not be dualistic. We are talking about that Bhagyan Tattva, non-dual reality. But again, in Mahaprabhu, Krishna is attaining what he couldn't attain as Krishna in Vrindavan. He's fulfilling these desires. He's known as Rasaraj, the king of all relishment of rasa. But there are some experiences he's lacking as Krishna in Vrindavan. So his name, Rasik Sekhar, Rasik Mohan, Rasaraj, only becomes justified as Mahaprabhu. He can fulfill that those things. And well, many of you are living in the land where such things take place. So you're very blessed, very fortunate. We are all very fortunate to be here today, sharing some thoughts about the ongoing expansion of love, how God becomes more love, and how Gaur Lila completes Krishna Lila. That's why many great teachers have called Gaur Lila the Parishishta Lila. Parishishta in Sanskrit means appendix, not the one in my body, the appendix of a book, which somehow concludes the book, like the afterthought, which makes full circle to what happened before. Krishna Lila is there, the book of Krishna Lila is there. Great. Then comes Parishishta Lila. The appendix Lila, Gaur Lila, that makes Krishna Lila not a failure. Makes Krishna Lila successful. Gaur Lila is the consequence of Krishna. If you play out the consequence of Krishna Lila, you end up in Gaur Lila. There's no other way about it. If you read Krishna Lila properly, and you read the implications of Krishna Lila, the implications of love between Radha and Krishna, if you are properly attuned to all this, you will conclude there has to be a Gaur Lila. It cannot finish with Krishna Lila. It's not possible. Because there are certain things that are happening that there has to be something to fulfill what the Krishna Lila is created. So Gaur Lila is that natural extension of Krishna Lila. It's that unique chamber of Vrindavan in the form of Navadvipa. But again, all this is happening by the ongoing, ever-evolving, ever-expanding nature of love that continue creates new chapters in the book of existence, in the life of God, even. So these are some thoughts that I want to share with you today based on, my not so recent at this point book, half a year ago was published probably. But was deeply inspired by the life of Mahaprabhu. I basically introduced my book saying this is an offering to Sri Chaitanya Dev because he's our deity, and Mahaprabhu personifies this principle of deep curiosity in the exploration of love. He remains a perpetual student in the school of love, and therefore he's guiding the way for us to follow in his footsteps. If God Himself considers Himself a student in the school of love, how much more we shall do so. Confirmation there. Thank you. Maybe that's Mahaprabhu calling, saying yes. That's correct. Yeah. That was the message Mahaprabhu was giving blessing.
Yes, in Chinese, Gaura Hari Das.
Okay, you cannot get more confirmation than that.
Question?
Let's open the door for questions. Yes.
Just some bit about Navadvip being a chamber of Vrindavan.
Okay.
It's a chamber of Vrindavan. I like that so much. It's actually, I wondered if you could delve more into that and speak more on that specifically because it's something I've really struggled to understand this interplay between Nitya Navadvip and the Vrindavan.
Nityanavadipan?
And Vrindavan.
You should have come to today's morning class. But we shared that online just in case. We talked all the lecture about Nityanavadip. I will say something is I'm not just sending you to a link and next question. Just that will be a more detailed exploration. But yeah, that's another important point that in our tradition, Navadvip is not just a temporary earthly realm, and in eternity we just go to Vrindavan and there's no more Navadvip. For those who have that attraction, Bhaktivinoda Thakur writes, Srila Sridhar Maharaj writes, and many others write, if you have an affinity to Gaur Lila, you will go to Gaur Lila in eternity. If you have an affinity to Krishna Lila, you go to Krishna Lila in eternity. If you have an affinity with both, you will go to both in eternity. That's interesting, right? Is there a personality split? No. Is there some type of bipolar eternal identity? Like, I'm like, no, don't try to again figure it out here, because the key for me there is that Navadvipa and Vrindavan are one. They are not two places. Krishna and Mahaprabhu are one person. They're not two different guys. They are the same person. Now, Krishna Lila and Gaur Lila is the same Lila from different emotional angles, if you will. Vrindavan and Navadvip are non different. They are just different expressions of the same reality. And as mysterious as this sounds, I like always to quote Bhaktivinoda Thakur in this regard, who will say, when some of these questions comes and we try to understand them more rationally and put the two together, because in our mind generally we cannot accommodate two things being one at the same time, but welcome, our philosophy is called Bed Abed. So from day one, it's okay, what's the name of your metaphysical system? Well, it's one and different. Okay. It's not one or different. No, it's one different achintya, conceivably at the same time, both together, existing simultaneously. Okay. That's the very structure of reality for us. In everything, there is something that is always one, the same, and there's always some diversity at the same time, not one canceling the other. So we can speak about from the Bhed perspective, Navadvipa and Vrindavan, different, certain, but from the Abhed perspective, they're one. So that demands a very rigorous inner discipline to remain walking this tightrope of balance between ones and different, one and different, one and different, one and different. Not going too much to the one, not going too much to the different. Because if we just go different, everything is different. There's chaos, conflict. We cannot see the interconnectedness of everything, the non-duality of reality. But if we go exclusively to the extreme of non-duality, we end up in Nirvishesh Brahman. No? And that's not our cup of tea. So our cup of tea is learning to navigate these two. So Navadvip and Vrindavan are the same place, basically. Experience from different emotional dispositions, like the different phases of the Absolute. Again, the Vatan says that Advaigyan Tattva, Rameti Palamatmeti Bhagavan Iti Shraddhate. Reality is Advaigyan Tattva, it's non-dual consciousness. No? Don't be afraid of saying reality is non-dual. You are not being an impersonalist for saying that. That's the Bhavatan. And that non-dual reality is expressed in Brahman, Paramatman, Bhagavan. But then you go to Bhagavan and you have Bhagavan, Vishnu, Bhagavan, Ram, Bhagavan, Krishna, Bhagavan, Shrimad Bhagavatam, Varaha, Mahaprabhu. Again, they are not different people. We are not polytheistic people. They are all the same person, expressing different emotional. Each avatar is an emotional moment in the life of the Absolute. So the same way, Krishna, Mahaprabhu, different emotional moments in the life of the Absolute. So as I was saying, as mysterious as this sounds, Bhaktivinoda Thakur will say, if all these ideas and concepts have not yet become an established realization in your heart, no problem, don't rush. All the things will be eventually accommodated and revealed to you in samadhi. In other words, in deep practice, we will have mercy, grace coming in our lives that will accommodate and allow us to understand things that maybe we have been struggling for years to put together. And it's not working, and it's not working. And I've heard many times, and it happened to me, and it happened to others. How to accommodate these two? It's not happening, not happening. And suddenly it's like, oh, it's happening. And a moment that you were not expecting that to happen, it just happened, by grace, by mercy. So it may take time. But I think it's important to emphasize the non-difference because as I speak in my second book in Radical Personalism, our tradition is so, how to say, so specialized in specificity. We can describe so many things in uttermost detail. We know the name of God's earrings. That's too much. Generally, you don't hear that anywhere else, right? And Radha has these ankle bells, and that's the name of the ankle bells. And there is not a god only, there is a goddess. And the goddess, we know which instrument she plays, it's a veena, and it has this particular name. And Krishna, the god, is a musician. He likes to play flute, and it has these varieties of flute, this size, one made of jewels, one bamboo, and this has this name. It's like, wow, give me a break. So much detail. So my point is, with all that detail and specificity and differentiation, we may lose sight of the non-duality of reality. And we start to compartmentalize, put things into different parts, and we lose the thread that unifies the whole thing. So we have to navigate Ved and Aved, unity and difference. So, yeah, regarding Navadvip, Vrindavan, Krishna, Mahaprabhu, sometimes it may be healthy to emphasize they're one. Stay with that for a while. They're one. They're not two different people. They're not two different realms. Learn to sit with that for a moment. Even if I cannot figure out other details, sit with it, pray with it. And eventually, whatever needs to be accommodated may be accommodated. And it's very interesting these dynamics because on one side we have someone like Prabodhananda Saraswati saying, Yata yata gouda padara vindam vindeta vaktim krita punya rasim tatat tatat sarpati hridya kashmat radha padam boja sudhamborasi. The more you go deeper into the service of Sri Gaur Hari, the more you immerse yourself in the service of Mahaprabhu, the more you emerge into the service of Sri Radha. So it seems like a Gaur Lila takes you to Krishna Lila. And then you have another verse from Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, which basically says in the other way around. The more you go deep into the service of Sri Radha, the more you become qualified for the service of Mahaprabhu. So one is taking to the other, and the other is taking to the other, no? In this way. It's a symbol of infinity. Just go on over and over. That's my answer today. Bhagavati Radha, yes.
You're saying how we cannot be outdated with our experience and how we relate to God. And sometimes it's keeping up, just like our faith leading us to something outside God's visions. And being raised in an environment, being told that this is the topmost knowledge, Goloka Vrindavan is the highest, or you know, Chaitanya Lila. There's a lot of guilt and shame, and it becomes hard to explore other faiths that could nourish an existing faith. So how do I navigate that? I know there is everything here in Gaudiya Vaishnavism, but it still feels very difficult to allow myself to have exposure to other kinds of others.
You read Radical Personalism and you seem to like it. So there you have received permission to explore other faiths around.
Shame and guilt about how everything is in Gaudiya Vaishnavism.
I mean, everything is in Gaudiya Vaishnavism, yes, but also one could make the same claim for any other genuine spiritual tradition, right? It's not that because everything is in Gaudiya Vaishnavism means that not everything is in other tradition other than Gaudiya Vaishnavism. No? Because then you start to become a religious fundamentalist. No? Okay, there is a place we can say, my tradition is perfect and complete. For me, no, I cannot make a claim beyond that. In my personal opinion, I should humble myself and qualify my statement saying, Gaudiya Vaishnavism is perfect, complete, and the best for me. For you, it may be, maybe not. Who I am to tell you what you should think, right? Now, that doesn't mean that for a genuine, I don't know, mystical Christian or mystical Sufi, whomever, as you may know, I like to hang out with people from sister traditions. I don't like even to call them other traditions. And they seem pretty satisfied in their experiences and practices and traditions, and they seem to experience their traditions as ideal and perfect and complete. So I'm not the type of person who is here to say, no. They are all an illusion. The only real deal is Gaudiya Vaishnavism, and everyone else is just tasting a partial piece of the cake. We have the center of it. And at some point in some lifetime, they will understand that, and they will join us. And eventually, everyone will converge in Golok Vrindavan, of course, right? Because there is no other department in transcendence but our kingdom. My gosh, you are a dangerous person if you think like that. You're ready to begin a war, whatever, right? So again, the game, the guilt and shame, and I'm talking in general because why each one feels guilt and shame is different. But many times that comes with certain assumptions before the guilt and shame, and on which basis the guilt and shame come. And the assumptions may be like, because your tradition, you have been told that your tradition is perfect. First of all, you could have been told so many things, but until and unless you experience those things as such, that's just dogma. I mean, I can say in full voice to the whole planet, my tradition is perfect and complete. And the wind will reply back, and have you had an experience of that? Because at the end of the day, I shouldn't be speaking beyond my own personal experience. So if we've had that experience, that's great. But again, Chaitanya Charitamrita says, every devotee feels their form of the divine, the preferred form of God is the best, and every devotee is correct. That's a pretty non-sectarian claim. So, again, I gave the example before. Prabhupada was asked, what do you think of Joan of Arc? Oh, that's Bhagavatam. I mean, he's not saying she's not a Gaudiya Vaishnav. Therefore, don't dare to study her life. You cannot be inspired with her because that will be a betrayal of your own faith. Be loyal to your tradition. He didn't say any of that. He immediately put her and threw her into the Bhagavatam, so to say. So that is the kind of spirit that our teachers try to present. Bhaktivinoda Thakur also, he was so open. He said, if you go to a church or a mosque, which assumes that it's in giving you permission to do that, right? If he's considering that possibility, is that he's open to the fact that you may visit there. It doesn't mean that everyone has to do that. Normalizing that possibility, and you witness different forms of adoration, you should be inspired by that. Not necessarily you have to convert to every other faith you witness, but you can be nourishing your own faith by witnessing others' faiths. We were talking the other day, we visited the place of Murari Gupta here in Mayapur. Again, Murari Gupta is Hanuman. No. He doesn't come from Braja Lila. No. Is he inferior? No. No. They both sometimes enter into these childish ways of measuring what's more elevated and higher and lower in terms of transcendence. I mean, will you dare to say Hanuman is inferior because he's a Rambhakta? I wouldn't dare to do that. Who wrote the first biography of Mahaprabhu? Hanuman. Murari Gupta. Sri Krishna Chaitanya Charitra. Mahakavya. A Rambhakta wrote the first biography of Mahaprabhu. Beautiful one. It's beautiful. So again, we are not saying, oh, that's another religion. You are Ram Bhakta. You don't have anything to do here in Gaur Lila. Gaur Lila is very accommodating. It's welcoming everyone. So, of course, as we always say, from which place I'm exploring sister traditions, how much I'm grounded in the tradition that I've chosen. Again, each case is unique. I'm just throwing general ideas here. Each case requires its own unique approach. And there is a place, as Srila Prabhupada have said too, also in the beginning, if I'm not even familiar with, okay, I say I'm a Gaudiya Vaishnava, but I have not so much a clear clue what's Gaudiya Vaishnavism. Maybe you may need to get grounded in what's Gaudiya Vaishnavism. Because if not, when you interact with other traditions, you may be confused. Not because the other traditions are bad, just because you are not properly grounded in maybe in anything. So, and if there's no proper grounding and getting a little bit of everything, it can create a confusion. It can create a confusion. We may not be getting a proper idea of our tradition, and we may not be getting a proper idea of others' tradition as well. And I would say the more grounded you are in your tradition, that happens to be the case, that same grounding in your tradition will allow you to have a more grounded perception of sister traditions also. If you're superficially connected to your tradition, probably you may connect superficially to other traditions. Because deep in their roots, all mystical traditions share so much in common. So if you are in touch with that common root from your tradition's perspective, you will be able to recognize that in sister traditions. No matter which external form it takes, you can perceive the natural, the common essence. So if one is properly situated and from a genuine place, one is integrating elements from sister traditions. I mean, as we were talking the other day, even our tradition. I remember some years ago I was in Colombia and I was giving a few lectures. And as you may know, in my lectures, I'm quoting mainly authors from our Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition, but also I may quote Rumi and Hafiz and Saint Francis and Joan of Arc or Richard Rohr, Ilya Delio, whomever. The author of The Little Prince, we quoted the other day. Very nice quote. And the devotee told me, "Oh, Maharaj, why you don't preach like why do not preach more traditional Gaudiya Vaishnavism?" And I asked, like, what do you mean by that? Traditional. You just quote our acharyas. Don't quote again all these other people from other traditions. And I was like, I could have answered in many ways, but I want to go to the point and I say, okay, so what will be traditional Gaudiya Vaishnavism? Give me an example of that. And he said, Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, Rupa Goswami. Okay, let's go there. Okay, Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu is a book about rasa. Do you know from where Rupa Goswami took the general structure of rasa for the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu? And of course, he didn't have a clue that that was the case. No. Oh, okay. He took that from a book of secular aesthetics, not even from a spiritual tradition. Natya Shastra from Bharat Muni. That's not only another spiritual tradition, it's just a secular book. He took that, and that became part of our tradition in its own way, of course. But there is a big borrowing from another place. And that became part of what we call traditional Gaudiya Vaishnavism. Give me another example. Okay, Jiva Goswami, Shatsandarbhas. You cannot get more traditional than that. Okay, let's go to the Shatsandarbhas. Jiva Goswami is quoting all over Madhvacharya, Ramanujacharya to support his points. They are technically from other traditions, other religions, somehow. He's even quoting Shankaracharya. And not only to refute him. So he's quoting a monist, an impersonalist, I have no problem with impersonalism. It's not just my cup of tea, but it's a possibility in transcendence. And Jiva Goswami is quoting Shankara to support his points. So my point is, our most traditional scriptures, what we think of most tradition, are bringing elements from other traditions. So that in itself for me is, shows that we were entertaining a false dichotomy, so to say. But again, for that, we may need to first be grounded enough in our tradition to realize how our own tradition is connected with our tradition. From there, we can engage in a safe and healthy conversation and communication. That for me is very healthy and necessary, not so we don't become overtly isolated in our own bubble, so to say. Not only with sister traditions, but even with the nuance in our own tradition, because there are so many ways of being sectarian and elitistic and exclusivistic and just showing Kanishta mentality, even in connection to the higher topics. So I can talk about Manjari Bhava and Radha Dasyam in the most fanatical and neophyte possible ways. And that's what usually happens in connection to the highest topics, which is the most disgusting thing possible. You want to bring bibhatsa rasa, the rasa of disgust. You talk about the higher things in the most neophyte possible way. That's like, oh, right. So I like to say, many times we engage so blatantly in this, what I like to call racism, which is to be racist in the context of rasa. Now, this is the highest rasa, the only one, this is the only thing a Mahaprabhu came to give. Whomever is not doing that, they are lower and inferior, they should go to another religion, blah, blah, blah. It's like, again, go and say that to Hanuman, to Murari Gupta, to the author of the first biography of Mahaprabhu. We have to develop honor and respect. The main book, first book of the Gaudiya Sampradaya that came up during Mahaprabhu's time, Brihadbhagavatamrita, Journey of Gopa Kumar, who happens not to be Manjari Bha, but in Sakya Rasa, just in case. And on his way to that Sakya Rasa, he's meeting Hanuman and so many other devotees from different religions and traditions. And he's not saying, you are inferior, you are not a Vraja Bhakta. Where's your Raganuga Bhakti? Come on. He's staying there with long time for long time, learning from them, incorporating bhakti samskars that somehow inform his journey to his preferred choice. But he's engaging in interfaith dialogue all the way across till he reached Goloka Vrindavan. And that's the first book of our Sampradaya to set reference to how the Sampradaya is supposed to unfold and how we are supposed to represent it. We have to pay close attention to those things, because if not, we took Brihadbhagavatamrita and quoted in a way to be a fanatical. So, and again, if some people want still to shame oneself, or no, you are unchaste, you are not loyal, that's your problem, not mine. So we'll say, not my circus, not my monkeys. No. If you want to think that I'm disloyal, that I'm deviant, there will always be someone thinking like that, right? So if we truly, sincerely are trying to do our best with guidance and support, still there will be dogs barking, no? Jackals howling. Let's make a more local example here. Jackal sounds way nicer than how some Gaudiya Vaishnav bark at one another. I'm beyond Gaudiya Vaishnavism. This happens in all traditions, right? So, yeah. Yeah, with proper guidance, support, and sincerity, there is place for openness and exploration and getting nourishment in so many directions. Bhagavatam is giving us these 24 gurus, beginning with planet Earth and wind and moon. And the message is clear. You are supposed to learn from all of them. But is the moon a Gaudiya Vaishnav? Right? And as I like to say, from those 24 gurus, 21 are non-human. And then the bigger shock is not that. The bigger shock is, okay, which are the three human ones? Well, one is a baby, the other is a little girl, and the third one is a prostitute. Okay. Is any of them affiliated with the Gaudiya Sampradaya? That's not the point. The ultimate point is you are supposed to learn from everyone, and guru is everywhere. The most important instruction of Mahaprabhu given to us is Trinada Bhisunichi, and that verse is saying, grass is your guru, tree is your guru. But it has been initiated by someone in this particular. That doesn't matter in one sense. So, yeah, are we being disloyal to my tradition by learning from a tree which is not affiliated to any tradition? Yeah, it's another way of thinking. We have to think in another way. Yeah. I hope that helps. Okay. I have a few more minutes if there are anything else you would like to share. Radha Priya? Yes. You can put two more points of volume. Thank you.
Staff is in the Vaishnava tradition practicing for 40 years or so, and she had a brother also who was very, very attractive. But he was also very drawn to Islam, and he was really confused. He didn't know which way to go, and we had a conversation with Srila Prabhupada. He asked, he said, "I'm so confused. I don't know where to give myself. I'm drawn to both." And Prabhupada said, "You find within yourself where you're drawn most deeply, and then give yourself to that." And he chose Islam. I just think that was crazy.
Yes, and Prabhupada was not trying to convert him back, so to say. Yeah, at the end of the day, we are servants of Shraddha Devi, right? We are all servants of faith. So whenever faith manifests in a genuine way, doesn't matter the tradition, but as long as it's genuine. Because as I also mentioned in radical personalism, some people remain as Gaudiya Vaishnavas for the wrong reasons. Right? So one could say, oh, they are keeping their faith in the tradition, but what's going on inside of them? Is their faith healthy? No. Do they remain as members of a school for the actual right reasons, or is that happening from a place that is toxic? And maybe there should, I mean, I'm not saying all this to encourage people leaving the tradition. I'm just saying, whatever the tradition of your choice, it has to be from a place of healthy participation. And healthy participation entails, at least for me personally, a considerable openness to dialogue with other traditions and sister traditions. And not only that, but being nourished by them, letting them. I'm speaking for myself here. Again, I'm not saying everyone should do what Padmanabhaswamy is doing. But in my personal experience, many times I've been able to rediscover Gaudiya Vaishnavism by the grace of sister traditions. So somehow I'm founding some particular, and I have people that I will consider Siksha gurus in my life who are not Gaudiya Vaishnavas. I have no problem saying that. I've said many times, for me, someone like Father Richard Rohr, he's my guru. Doesn't mean he gave me Christian Diksha or anything. Again, the Bhagavatam say that the moon can be your guru, the grass can be your guru. Yeah, but not a Franciscan author. And in his company and by his grace, I've gained a deeper understanding of Gaudiya Vaishnavism. And I'm not tempted to abandon Gaudiya Vaishnavism. On the contrary, Again, I'm not saying everyone should do what I'm doing, but that's how it works for me, and there is a place for that to happen. So, yeah.
Hi, Krishna Maharaj.
Welcome.
Really appreciate your presence and the discussion.
And we were waiting for you to manifest, so great. Here you are.
Sorry to disappoint you.
No. That was not the subliminal message. Just, we are happy to see you. Welcome.
Saraswati Devi is speaking. So we see Acharyas like Bhaktivinoda Thakur, you mentioned, and Srila Prabhupada also emphasizing in certain times and this spirit of non-sectarianism and encouraging everyone in their relationship with the Lord as their heart is feeling inspired. Other times, these same Acharyas engage in what we might call religious criticism, like literary criticism. You know, they're pointing out certain, let's say, inconsistencies in doctrine that have some kind of logical faults, let's say.
In connection to other traditions.
Yes, they're pointing out the logical faults, the inconsistencies in certain other religious traditions. And this goes back all the way to Vyasadeva in the Siddhanta Sutra. He's doing the same thing in relation to Buddhism. So, how can we understand this apparently contradictory stance? On the one hand, sometimes encouraging specific individuals to pursue a path that they feel is best for them, and at the same time, in other times, in other contexts, engaging in this religious criticism and pointing out certain things that seem to contradict their guidance that they give to these individuals.
Thank you for the question. So there are a few things I will share. And again, this is an ongoing conversation. I don't try here to say we may have a few minutes to reply to something that requires a separate 2-week retreat. So probably our next 2-week retreat in Mayapur will be revolving this topic. Because yeah, we find again there is the problematic of Acharya saying not only about this but about other things. One thing here, one thing there. My first book basically is about that, in the topic of bhakti, whether it's inherent or inherited, as I like to make the play of words. And we find not only different Acharyas saying different things, but the same Acharya saying different things at different moments. So shall we cherry pick what's more convenient and comfortable, or shall we try tattoo samambayat, like Vedanta say, try to reconcile all apparent inconsistencies. Yeah. So in regards to your topic or to your question, of course we should address every specific case, but I agree, and I'm not denying that sometimes we will hear, to give an example, I don't know, someone like Srila Prabhupada speaking strongly about impersonalism, just to give an example, and explaining why he's doing that. At the same time, again, bringing everything into the picture, there are many statements, and I know it's a complex topic, but life is complex. Let's embrace complexity. He will acknowledge that you can attain impersonal liberation, though at times he will say you fall from there, but at times say you don't fall from there. Anyhow, he acknowledges that's a path. It's not our path. It's not our choice. We don't want to merge into non-differentiated Brahman. But that's mentioned in scripture. That's even prescribed in scripture. But of course, he's speaking to us. I mean, you cannot isolate the speaker from the audience the speaker is speaking to us. They say when someone is speaking, writing a book, generally you are having the best reader in mind. You are thinking about who is reading my book, and you write with the reader in mind. So there is some audience that's putting what you are sharing in context. And we have to go to every case, every acharya says something to which, to which person, or in which time, in which society, in which climate, social climate. All those things bring an element there. So for me, again, all this, there's no one straight answer that I'm telling you. Because of this happened. Next question. Every case is very particular. Like the famous example, and again, I know some of these topics may sound controversial, and I know that for some, Swami Padmanabha has acquired some fame of being controversial. I don't like to be controversial, but just some topics need to be spoken about. Prabhupada at times say we fell from Vaikuntha, and at times he say nobody falls from Vaikuntha, which sounds quite the opposite. So why he say that? And part of the answer is we may never know why he say that. We may never know the exact intention at any every given statement in every specific situation. Why you say that to that devotee that day at that time? We may never be able to know that. We may just infer, we may speculate, and it's a valid exercise. But many times I will argue it's in consideration of the certain religious, social, cultural background of the audience, and they may need to hear certain topics with certain religious language and symbolism and notions, because I don't know, talking about anadi karma will be off the charts, right? Beginningless entanglement. It's like, what? Okay, you fell from Vaikuntha. Yeah. Started. Okay, go there, whatever. It's another topic, but it's similar in the sense of. I personally don't believe that someone like Prabhupada or Bhaktivinoda Thakur are truly sectarian in their essence, that they really think only Gaudiya Vaishnavism is the real deal and everyone else at some point needs to come to us. I generally don't feel that. I can understand why at times they may have used strong words in specific cases. Or like with every tradition, there is this criticism to each other in terms of having differences of perspective and opinion. I wouldn't say it's just trying to demolish the other party and prove myself as victorious, but just things I may think differently. And there is this culture of debate in India about conversations in this direction. And also, I will say there is this aspect of what we may call the difference, and sorry to use so many complicated words today, but there's one thing is the ontological thing, another thing is what's called the axiological thing, which will be akin to, in English, saying tattva vichar and rasa vichar, which means, vichar means discernment. So one thing is to speak about things in their ontology, what they are, another according to rasa. To particular taste, a personal taste. So, in a more impartial view, we could say, yeah, all religions are valid, all bona fide traditions, mystical traditions are there. But on the perspective of my personal taste, I may feel drawn to a particular tradition. And in that context, I may speak about other traditions, not as inferior, but just in the context of my particular taste. And sometimes when you have a lot of taste for something, your expressions about whatever everything else is may kind of be perceived as critic or fanatic or I don't know, for example. And of course, now I'm going to an extreme example. But if you read, I don't know, a book like Chaitanya Charitamrita by Prabodhananda Saraswati, we have been studying that before our parikram to warm up into who is Mahaprabhu. And in those verses, Prabhupada Nanda Sarasvati is praising Mahaprabhu in a very like ecstatic, fervent way. And you can see he's really biased in a holy way to Mahaprabhu. And there are verses who say, when he says, who cares for Varaha lifting the earth? Who cares for that? Who cares for this avatar and for that avatar? Who cares for all of that? No. Now that Mahaprabhu is here, I don't care for it. No, so from a perspective, if you take it impartially, ontologically, that's offensive. He's dismissing all these Vishnu tattvas and he's saying we shouldn't care for them. But he's not talking from a point of impartial, ontological conclusion, but from a very unique axiological, rasa-like subjective experience that makes him express about others in ways that sound like. But the statement is not about the others are so low, but I'm having such a deep taste for this in particular. But the other things may come as a criticism. So I will say that sometimes our acharyas will say some things that taken without context may sound like, no, how to say, not too sensitive to other traditions, but they come from a deeply ecstatic place, no? Of personal experience. So some thoughts, again, I'm not giving any conclusive answer because each case is particular, but it's a good topic to remaining open to conversation with. Yeah. Thank you. Okay, it's 8 p.m. I don't want to take much more of your time, so we'll put the sharing to rest for today. Yeah. Not forever. The conversation is ongoing always. Nityam Bhagavata Sevaya Katayanta Shamam Nityam Kirtaniya Sada Hari Satatam Kirtayantamam. Perpetually engaging into this exchange. So thank you so much for coming and giving me us the opportunity of this moment of sharing Sadhu Sangha, Sankirtan, Katha. And looking forward to meeting you all soon, keeping in touch in one way or another. Sriman Mahaprabhu ki jai, Sri Hari Nam Sankirtan ki jai, Gaur Bhaktavrinda ki jai, Sri Mayapur Dham ki jai, Sri Navadvip Dham ki jai, Gaur Brahmanand, Mancha Kalpataru Vishra Kripasandhu Vyai Vacha, Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo, Samaveda Bhaktavrinda ki jai.